Morning, Your Honors. Jack Catrone. I only have 6 minutes. I won't waste my time. I'm arguing only the sentencing points from the consolidated brief. I would start with language from this court, from a decision just last year. We begin with the plain language of the guidelines provision at issue. When construing the guidelines, we look first to the plain language, and where that is unambiguous, we need look no further. U.S. versus Puig, and that similar ideas were expressed in a number of other cases cited in our brief. I will address first the grouping point, and I will address first the arguments with respect to Mr. Litwin as to the grouping.
In your view, do the tax counts and the bankruptcy counts always have to be grouped?
It depends under which section of the guideline, or which is the appropriate section of the guidelines for sentencing. Because of Your Honor's question, I'll switch to Mr. Chavin's argument with respect to grouping. There are two different bases for his argument. One is that the guidelines provide that the offenses listed in the following guidelines are to be grouped. I don't know how much more clear that language could be.
So is the answer yes, they always have to be grouped?
It depends on, Your Honor, I'm not trying to avoid the question, but it's it depends on which guideline the particular bankruptcy offense falls under. With respect to certain bankruptcy offenses, sentencing guideline is not included in that list. Where the bankruptcy guideline for the particular offense charged falls within the group, the answer is clearly yes. The Sentencing Commission said offenses listed under the following guidelines are to be grouped. Again, I don't know how much more clear that language could be. What happened in the district court with respect to grouping as to both defendants was that the district court relied on a recommendation from the probation officer arguing against grouping, and the basis for the probation officer's assessment, which was adopted by the district court, was that the victims were different. Well, fine, that applies to Category A of the grouping subsection. It applies to Category B. It does not apply to Categories B and D.
Has no application at all?
No,
not
absolutely not.
A factor can be considered?
No, it is not, because the guidelines say that. Now, the guidelines, in talking about grouping, says that if they involve substantially the same harm, they are to be grouped. Now, maybe this court wouldn't have defined substantially the same harm the way the Sentencing Commission did. Maybe the government wouldn't. But unfortunately, for the government, the Sentencing Commission defined what is to be considered substantially the same harm. And it created four separate categories. And the guidelines say, flat out, if any of them apply, the offenses are to be grouped. Again, with respect to Mr. Litwin, just briefly, where one offense is used as an enhancement of the sentencing in the other, they are to be grouped. The government's brief makes the unbelievable assertion that the perjury in the bankruptcy proceeding was not for purposes of concealing the tax evasion that was charged. The government's own indictment charges specifically opposite. And certainly, it would be preposterous.
Were any extra levels added to the tax offense on account of the bankruptcy offense?
Because it, through the concealment, yes. There were extra levels added to Mr. Litwin.
No. I'm on account of the bankruptcy offense. That is, suppose no bankruptcy petition had ever been filed. What would the effect have been on the calculation of the offense level for the tax offense?
Your Honor, we don't know.
No, well, you can tell us. You've seen the exact calculation. What would the consequence have been?
I don't know for certain whether the district court in this case would have applied the sophisticated concealment. I'm suggesting that if, and I think this will respond to Your Honor's question, I apologize if Your Honor thought I was trying to avoid it. If any part of the enhancement is based on the second offense.
Based on the second offense?
Yes.
But one can try to conceal a tax crime without filing for bankruptcy. In
Certainly.
Fact, we see that all the time.
Certainly.
And if the sentence, if the offense calculation for the tax offense would have been exactly what it was had the bankruptcy petition never been filed, then the bankruptcy offense has not been used as an enhancement in the tax offense, and the rule that you're invoking about grouping is just inapplicable.
I'm afraid that I don't agree with the court's premise with respect to if the sentence would have been the same. The bankruptcy...
But that's the critical question from your own perspective. We need to figure out whether the bankruptcy, whether the commission of the bankruptcy crime led to a greater offense level for the tax crime.
I believe that was...
If you say you don't know...
I believe that... I'm sorry, Your Honor. When I said I don't know, I meant I didn't know what the effect would have been in the district court's calculation. But in fact, it was used as an enhancement in this case, and therefore the guideline applies. I see I'm into my rebuttal time, so unless the court has further questions, I'll reserve any further argument.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mr. Ackerman.
Thank you, Your Honor. Gentlemen of the prosecution.
Judge Edmonds,
good morning.
I bring three issues. None of them are startling. I hope they're thought-provoking. Should Mr. Litwin have been given the opportunity to proceed as co-counsel? Clearly, the standard of review is abuse of discretion, although the government paints it as de novo. I will tell the court it's abuse of discretion. In this case, our position is the district court did abuse its discretion. Mr. Litwin painted himself as somebody who knows something about land trusts and a little bit about taxes. The case was about, in part, land trust and certainly taxes. His counsel did not object to this. The government objected. The district court's ruling is set out in the separate appendix, my separate appendix, and it's a thoughtful but erroneous decision. There is no reason, even though it's disfavored, not prohibited, there is no reason in this case that Mr. Litwin should not have been provided the opportunity to act as co-counsel. He told the district court there would be no double teaming. He would not provide a summation. He would not cross-examine.
The district court, he would testify in his own defense, too. He doesn't seem to be a truth-telling person.
I think the circumstances at hand were such that once he was denied the opportunity to appear as co-counsel, I would assume all bets were off, and I think that's a fair reading of the record. And clearly he did not testify. So, assume for a moment that the district court had allowed him. I think the reasonable question would be, what if he did not testify? I think the district court had any number of options, not the least of which would have been contempt proceedings, because of a clear material misrepresentation to the court by an officer of the court. There is no suggestion he would have disrupted the proceedings. There is no suggestion that the proceedings would have been obstructed in or impeded in any way. That's his argument on that issue. There's an issue relating to whether this court can find as a matter of law that Marvin Glickman was incredible. We suggest to the court that there are any number of cases where informants in drug-related cases have lied about ABC, and the court generally takes the position, as it should, that credibility is for the trier of fact. We point out in our opening brief that this court in Ray Chavin, the same Leonard Chavin, said that there are times when a witness is simply so incredible or the language or the position so improbable that the court is justified in finding that the person is incredible as a matter of law, and indeed, Mr. Chavin was so found. Well, he who steals from his mother, he who steals from his sister, he who steals from everybody in sight, and he who agrees has a short-term memory loss, and he who agrees that he's lied to everybody, and indeed he told the story about stuffing 10 or 15,000 in cash in his pockets and going to a bank where Litwin had no bank account. I think the composite might be a case where the court should consider the issue of whether in a criminal case there may be an individual who is so lacking in any form of credibility that it was unreasonable for the jury to take the case, and the district court was wrong here. Finally, we take the position there's no evidence on counts 4 and 6, which are the tax evasion counts, substantive evasion counts for 1993 and 1994. The evidence in the case at hand is that Mr. Kessler, the government's immunized witness, prepared those tax returns for Mr. Chavin. Mr. Litwin had nothing to do with it at all. Didn't supply anything. The only thing he did make available was when Mr. Kessler asked for records, they were there. And I should add that Mr. Kessler, in this particular case, had the $675,000, and the $300,000 in his possession when he prepared Chavin's tax returns. That's our position. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Ackerman. Mr. Price.
At this point of time, I will address two issues regarding Mr. Chavin. Of course, I ask the court to consider all the issues considered in their joint brief. The thrust of this argument would be that the cross-examination of Mr. Sharp, Jay Sharp, was limited. If Jay Sharp's cross-examination had been allowed to go further regarding Mr. Kessler, we would have found that Mr. Kessler had committed any number of errors in connection with the preparation of Mr. Chavin's return. Those errors would, in fact, have inured to the benefit of the government and not necessarily Mr. Chavin. I believe one would have inured to the benefit of Mr. Chavin. The circumstances were such that Mr. Kessler, what he did was, prepared the returns, and Mr. Chavin and his wife ran into the office, signed the returns, and left. Mr. Kessler had been given all the information concerning the transaction of sale. The bad debt loss had been discussed with him regarding what the future possibilities were. It was recorded on the 92 return. The carryover was taken in the future years. He relied on his accountant. The lawyer also relied on the accounting phase of the real estate transaction and what could be done. The further issue that's raised is the instructions. The government claims there was a waiver of this issue. I submit not. If the instructions are clear from the record, the defendant submitted an instruction rejected by the court, stated the proof of a signature on a document, even when signed under penalty of perjury, is not sufficient in and of itself to establish that the person signing the document is aware of its contents. Such a signature is but one fact that must be considered along with all the other evidence to establish the defendant was aware of the contents of the document. Submit to the court, that would have been an appropriate instruction. In a reading of the submission by the government in their argument, it's quite clear that Mr. Cottrell, who represented Mr. Chavin at trial, at some point of time, the judge indicated that she would preserve the objections, and Mr. Cottrell made some reference to the fact, well, let's go on ahead, we'll accept that for now, and there was no intent to waive it. Once the court says we're going to preserve objections, they are preserved. For those reasons, it made it very difficult for the theory with regard to reliance on the advice of the tax professional to survive. And it sort of, I think, got lost. And with regard to Mr. Chavin, although it's not argued in his individual brief, he was the one who relied on the professional advice of Mr. Kessler. Mr. Sharp was certainly an appropriate witness. He had been a witness in the federal court on previous occasions. He had been tendered as an expert witness, except in one area the government agreed he was qualified, and he was certainly more qualified than Mr. Ellis, who testified as a witness for the government. We had no experience in connection with the area that was discussed in this case, namely the taking of the Van Dead Bus. I didn't mean to speak quite so fast, but because of the constraints of time, Your Honors, I would like to save some time to respond to the government if I feel it's necessary.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Price. Mr. Bindi.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. David Bindi for the United States. Regarding the district court's decision not to group, the basis for that decision was that the harms were involved in the tax and the bankruptcy offenses were not substantially the same harm. And that is the fundamental premise of grouping decisions. That is what drives grouping decisions. If offenses involve substantially the same harms, they are to be grouped. Now, the guideline does list various offenses that are to be grouped, as Mr. Catrone pointed out. But we know from the cases cited in both briefs, both sets of briefs, that grouping under that provision is not automatic. There are instances of cases where offenses listed under guidelines in the to-be-grouped category are not grouped. Fraud cases and drug cases, or fraud counts and drug counts, are, the Harper case from the 11th Circuit points out, drug and money laundering counts are not readily susceptible to grouping together. In this case, the decision not to group the tax and the bankruptcy counts was made on the basis that the offenses involved different types of harms. The bankruptcy fraud involved a financial loss to individuals and corporations or banks. this is a private harm. The tax counts involved a public harm. When people evade taxes, it has an impact on the government, on the citizenry, on the economy that goes beyond just counting dollars.
You're taking the victims into account.
You're
taking the victims into account, who the victims are.
I'm taking them into account, yes, Your Honor, that's true. I'm not saying that the decision not to group should be affirmed because there were different victims. I'm just saying that it's a factor. It should be taken into account here because the kinds of harms done can, in some instances, and in this one in particular, be affected by who the victim is. Mr. Litwin has made the argument that it was an abuse of discretion not to allow him to represent himself for portions of the trial. Regardless of what the standard of review is, there is no error here. Under this court's cases, hybrid representation is either forbidden or disfavored, even if you go with just disfavored.
Well, what would be the problem here? Most of these hybrid representation cases are court-appointed lawyers representing unschooled defendants, and you don't want to give someone that opportunity to also represent themselves during the trial. They'll be all over the place and so on. This guy is a lawyer. Why couldn't he represent himself on a portion of the case?
Your Honor, I think that's kind of problematic because what you're talking about is establishing different standards based on the status of the defendant. Someone who is uneducated or unschooled is not allowed to joint representation, whereas someone with an education, particularly a legal education, would get more favorable consideration. The reasons for the rule remain the same. Educated.
If somebody has a lot of money, you can have a number of lawyers represent you during the trial.
And that is his right, Your Honor, if he's expending his own resources. But what he's not entitled to under any circumstances, I'm unaware of any case that says that under any particular set of circumstances, any defendant is entitled to hybrid representation, and the refusal to allow it is reversible error. It's disfavored. There are reasons why it's disfavored. The cases that we've cited and that the defendant has cited catalog those reasons.
I just don't see what the harm was here and why the government objected to it.
Well, the government, obviously, I think, well, I can't speak for the trial team, but it was the government's prerogative to object because of the case law. The case law says that this method of procedure at trial is, at the very least, disfavored. And it was within, obviously, Judge Pallmeyer's prerogative not to allow it to go forward that way. The argument that Michael Glickman's testimony was incredible as a matter of law is just simply not sustainable. The cases say that a witness can be found incredible as a matter of law if his testimony is so inherently improbable on its face that it's unworthy of belief. The story Glickman told of the events that he was witness to is not inherently implausible. He was shown through cross-examination and on direct examination as well to be a thoroughly disreputable character. But that does not make everything he has to say inherently implausible and incredible as a matter of law. With regard to Litwin's conviction on counts 3 and 4, clearly Pinkerton liability lies here. He was very instrumental in structuring that bad debt loss that had to be carried over into the subsequent returns, and he had every reason to believe that Mr. Chavin would in fact carry over those losses. Mr. Chavin argues that his expert, Jason Sharp's testimony was unduly restricted. Mr. Sharps was allowed to testify regarding every single line item on Chavin's tax return that he would have handled differently than had Sam Kessler. The only thing he was not allowed to do was to say that where he and Kessler differed, Kessler made a mistake. The only point that Chavin makes now regarding the relevance of that particular line of inquiry, that there were mistakes made on the return, has to do with possible sentencing issues regarding the amount of tax loss. That obviously is not a jury issue, and it was proper for the district court to restrict the examination of Sharps along those lines. Mr. Chavin has also argued here today that his proposed signature instruction, that his objection to the one that was given was not waived. I think it's noteworthy that both in his argument here today and in his reply brief, he does not mention the merits of the issue. And the government's position on the merits of the issue is that there was no material difference between the instruction that was given and the instruction that Mr. Chavin initially proposed. The instruction that was given to the jury told them that the bare fact of a signature on the return was not conclusive. It was merely one factor among a number of factors that they would have to consider. There is no material difference between the proposed instruction and the given instruction, and the exact wording of instructions is a matter that is left to the sound discretion of the trial court. Your Honors, for these reasons, we would respectfully request that the decision, that the judgment in this case be affirmed. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Bindi. Anything further, Mr. Catrone?
Your Honor, yes. In reply to some of Mr. Bindi's arguments, Your Honor was exactly correct. His basic argument is that the victims are different and therefore the grouping should not apply. What the guideline says, number one, is that as to offenses where the offense level is based on the measure of the aggregate money, harm, or loss, they are to be grouped. Certainly whether it's tax evasion, which is a fraud on the government, and the polity, or whether it's bankruptcy fraud where the victim are the creditors, the measure of the harm is the aggregate monetary loss. And the government, while pointing to one of the one portion of the guideline example says that they aren't of the same general type, but they neglect to include the following, or the last of the language: the same general type is to be construed broadly and would include, for example, larceny, embezzlement, forgery, and fraud. Clearly, under the plain language of the guidelines, they should have been grouped. And just briefly, as to the question of Mr. Bindi has argued that the cases hold that if they're listed, they don't necessarily have to be grouped. We've listed in our brief a number of cases from about five or six circuits which say they are. There is a case cited by the government from one circuit which says they don't have to be. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Counsel. Anything further, Mr. Ackerman? All right. Mr. Price.
Just very briefly. Your Honor, the discussion by the government relative to the examination of Mr. Sharps. Mr. Kessler had testified already. He wasn't coming back, and he didn't come back for sentencing. And the only way to attack his credibility was to put an expert up against him. And Mr. Kessler certainly had an interest in the matter. He prepared an improper return. He'd been granted immunity. So I submit to Your Honor that it did affect the calculation, and Mr. Sharp's examination continued to the extent that it could have. It would have eventually affected the calculation of the tax, even to a greater extent than Mr. Sharp's was able to calculate the effect of the tax, or the tax amount at the time of the sentencing in connection with his submission. So I think it was a significant restriction and could have affected the calculation of the tax loss. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you to all counsel in the case. The case will be taken under advisement.